Breadfilm Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the BFI London Film Festival 2014, joined by filmmaker Tala Hadid, who is presenting the film The Narrow Frame of Midnight here at the festival. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Right, so I guess the best way to start the interview would be to tell our listeners a little something about the story of the film, although it's going to be a bit difficult when it comes to this film.
Well, the story of the film in brief is the film is about a man who is a European but of Moroccan and Iraqi origin, and essentially his brother has disappeared, so he travels to Morocco, he arrives in Morocco, and he starts searching for his brother, and he essentially traces the map of his brother's disappearance. So the journey takes him from Morocco through Turkey, and he ends up in Baghdad in Iraq during the war, meaning this last war of this last decade. And along the route on his journey, he meets a young girl who's about 7 years old, who's a mountain girl who's been sold to a pimp, and so she's trying to escape, and they travel for part of the journey together. And so those two, and then their journeys diverge. So that's essentially, it's a film about a journey.
Was that the main inspiration, making a film about a journey, or was there any other source of inspiration to make this film?
Well, I think that, you know, when you make a film, there are like many, many inspirations that work on a lot of different levels. And so, yes, journeying, of course, is an idea, because on a journey, you cross terrain, both geographic and emotional and spiritual, and so it's a good framework. But the inspiration, if you want to call it that, was actually one of the important thoughts behind it, was an idea of how you would look at the world, and this is for all the main characters in the film, like how you might look at the world with new eyes, and especially if the world needs to be reinvented or looked at anew, and that is the case in the world of this film and in the world that we live in. That's a separate story.
I agree. Is it fair to call this film kind of an interactive experience? Because I definitely found it to be so.
Yes, I'm very happy that you say this, actually, because I think the film asks you to participate. It asks you as a spectator, or it asks the audience to not submit to it, but to join and to enter into its world and experience each scene both visually and orally, because the sound is very important, just as important as the image in this film. And so it asks for the spectator to interact with it, to fill in the blanks, to make the connections, and to think.
Especially even in the narrative, not everything is told in this story. We're almost asked to fill in the blanks. So, what was the reason behind that approach?
Well, I mean, I watch all kinds of films, and I love all different types of films from many different countries, and I thought, well, you know, for my own journey in film, you know, I didn't want to have a story that could be consumed easily. So a narrative, for example, that might follow an equation of A plus B equals C, right? So that it would be open-ended, more like A plus A plus A plus A, which is actually an idea from a French philosopher called Deleuze, which is sort of this open-ended constant questioning, that the questioning is more important than the answer. And so this is a fundamental idea, was really, really important. And so I think it's good to participate. Actually, there's no missing information, but there are grey areas where the audience is allowed to maybe think it could be this or it could be that, and
I mean, if I were to describe this film, I wouldn't just call it interactive, I'd also call it hypnotic, because of the rhythm of the film, and obviously there was a great attention to the flow, the way the camera moves, like you mentioned. So can you tell us a little bit about the technical aspect of the film, your choices?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think that I pretty much knew way in advance how the shots would be, how the sequences would be shot, and the rhythms of the film. Because I'm very generally interested in the moving image in terms of time. So, like, containing time in a shot. And then afterwards, so technically, you know, these were sequences that were plotted out in advance, and also with the cinematographer, Alexander Burov, where we, you know, essentially embarked on a technical sort of structure that that was constantly moving, that balanced between movement and stillness. And then coming back to the rhythm is very important because it has a strange rhythm. It does have a hypnotic rhythm, and that was partially intentional, but also that it's a different kind of rhythm. Does this make sense? Like, it's a strange kind of rhythm. It's fluid, but the rhythm of the film is strange, and I think strange in a good way.
Almost musical. I mean, if you were to listen to like a song with the rhythms changing, and
yes, absolutely. But also like a poem, so musical, or like a poem which has a very different tempo than a novel.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So and the sound too. I mean, it adds to the experience. Obviously, you're drawn into the atmosphere.
Yeah. Sound was crucial. You know, as we all know, sound is very, 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 very important. But for me, at least in my work, the sound is as important as literally as important as the image. And so that, you know, there's no score in the film, and so the score is, or the score, the music of the film are all the sounds and the natural sounds of the world, meaning the wind in grass, or creakings of, you know, old wood, or distant chimes, or the breath of the young girl. You know, every single sound in this film was constructed with care, but also creatively, so that it would actually have an effect subconsciously on the viewing.
Yeah, enhancing the narrative in the process.
Enhancing the narrative. I mean, I'm a great admirer of Walter Murch, who is a sound designer, a great artist, who and theorist, sound theorist, who did work on Apocalypse Now and Godfather. And
wonderful. Let's talk about the acting too. I mean, I was really taken by the performance of the young girl. She's extremely, like, I think even the three performances as a whole, they're kind of restrained, but in this sense they're even more human, didn't you think so?
What you're saying about the restraint, that was also something very, well, because I started from a point where I told the actors, work together, that I would want them to be as close as possible to the characters on the page. That the character exists on the page, but only in a very, very, not superficial way, but very light way, and that they would have to fill in, they themselves as people would have to fill in the rest, because in the end they're the ones who are being filmed by the lens.
So there's a lot of themselves, their own personalities and their performance.
Themselves and their own personalities, just so it could be as natural as possible. And so that there's that in terms of the and the restraint as well, because it's also a very internal film. So and then the second thing with the little girl is that she's not an actor, you know, at all. So I found her on the street a week before shooting, because I'd lost somebody else, another girl who'd pulled out, and she's miraculous as a person. Like, she's, you know, goes to school, lives with her mother, but pretty much spends a lot of her time on the street. She's very, very, very tough, and she's really smart, and she's just a brilliant child. So
she's almost like an embodiment of innocence, and all these things are threatened in her the whole time. I just found that aspect as well to be an extremely powerful one in the film.
Yes, and but she's innocent, but this was also the she's like this and the character is like this, is that she's innocent but very strong. I mean, she's probably the strongest of all of the characters, because she's touched by grace somehow, maybe because she's a child, but more than that, she's got a very strong will. And so the others are quite weak, actually, if you look at it close. But I mean, the adults are quite weak, all of them are broken in some way, but except for her.
Was it difficult to bring this film to life, to bring it to the big screen?
Well, yes, I think it was difficult. I think probably with a lot of films, but especially like independent films and films from the South, it's very difficult to get funding. So it took a long time to cobble together different funds, because you know it's a balancing act. So my producers did an amazing job of balancing funds from like different state bodies and institutions and some private equity. And, you know, by some miracle, I don't know how it all came together. And it is, and I think every film when it starts is a miracle, because it's so hard to find funding, that, you know, just to have the money to make a film.
So. Now it's made and it's a great film. What's the next step for the film? Are we going to see it released in getting a wider release? Or,
well, in the UK, I mean, it's in the works, so we hope and we'll see. So it's screening a few more times in London. It's screening at the London Film Festival, and then it's screening in London again at the end of October at the Hackney Picture House. And it'll be screening in many different festivals over the next few months. So sort of travelling around with it. So yes, of course, I hope we get distribution.
Well, I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks very much for talking with us. Thanks very much, and congratulations once again on an amazing film. And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio. 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.